Good evening and welcome to another edition of Little Atoms, the show about ideas, with me, Neil Denny. Each edition of Little Atoms features a guest from the worlds of science, journalism, politics, academia, human rights, or the arts in conversation. If the show has a dominant and recurring theme, then it coalesces around the ideas of the Enlightenment, by which we mean freedom of expression, free inquiry, empirical rationalism, scepticism, the scientific method, secular humanism, and liberal democracy. Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. And that last sentence could have been written especially for our guest tonight, the writer Julie Burchill, making her second appearance on Little Atoms. Julie Burchill has been a writer since the age of 17. She has written columns for The Guardian, The Times and The News of the World. She is also the author of several novels, including Sugar Rush, which became an Emmy Award-winning television series, and a number of non-fiction books, including Made in Brighton. Joining Julie on the show tonight is the writer Chaz Newkey-Burden. Chaz has written columns for Attitude, Time Out, and The Big Issue. He is the author of a number of books, including Great Email Disasters and Amy Winehouse, The Biography. This interview was recorded earlier this week, and Julie and Chaz and I talked about a book that they have co-written called Not In My Name, A Compendium of Modern Hypocrisy. Julie, thanks very much for agreeing to be on Little Atoms again.
It's always lovely to see you.
And Chaz, thanks for coming along as well.
Thank you.
Not In My Name, A Compendium of Modern Hypocrisy. Why did you decide, what motivated this?
I've known Julie for a couple of years now, and you know, we see a lot of things the same way and we share a lot of views and interests, and we realised that what was underpinning a lot of our observations on the world was a disliking of hypocrisy, but also I think a really good ability to sniff it out in any situation, to find the hypocrisy in any situation, be it a huge global issue or just something quite frivolous and day-to-day. We both, you know, enjoy each other's writing, and so, you know, I was surprised when it all started at first, but I thought about it the other day and I think it was always going to happen.
So how do you define hypocrisy then, before we, without going into any of the issues which we'll obviously talk about later, how do you define it?
I mean, in terms of the book, we did make it sort of quite broad. You get sort of double standards, i.e. one set of standards being applied to one type of people and then another, you know, expectation of a second set of people. It really is, it's finger wagging from somebody who has no right to. For instance, I mean, just a quick very example is I talk about Amy Winehouse knockers in the book, people who, you know, are rude to her about her lifestyle. If somebody who lives the life of a nun says, I think you should stop snorting coke to her and staying up all night drinking gin or whatever, that's one thing.
That's all well and good.
Yeah, when Francis Rossi of Status Quo,
who said that his septum was so worn through with cocaine, he could put a bit of string up one nostril and put it down through the other. I bet Amy can't do that.
You know, when he does it, it's hypocrisy.
Yeah.
So, you know, that would be the way I'd explain it.
So what was it like working together on the book?
Well, I always say, catch them young and play on their emotions and they'll do more than their fair share of the work. What was so great about when I met Chaz, he was working for The Big Issue, and normally, if I like someone's writing, I'll send him a postcard straight away. I've done it so many times, and every time I would read something by him, I'd think, bloody hell, that's what I think too. And I'm afraid to say that I saw he had a hyphen in his name. I thought, I'm not writing a postcard to no posho, which is pathetic looking back. But when I finally met him, I was put in the position of saying, I love your work. And then I said, I almost sent you a postcard. And it's the only time I've had to say that, because normally I do act on my impulses straight away. And I just felt really shabby about that. But as we sat down to talk in Brighton when I was promoting Sugar Rush, I did suddenly realise that it was even better than I thought it was, that he wasn't just this person who seemed to think the same way about me and lots of issues, but that, as a personality, is just the most charming, passionate and chivalrous person you could hope to meet.
And not too posh.
Not too posh. Well, you see, the thing is, when I went down, I thought, I got a double barrel surname, I like football, my mum's East European. I'll be lucky to get through the door. But, you know, that's how things sort of work. And in terms of writing with Julie, I'd love to say that, you know, it was a living hell and I had to peel her grapes for her. I really would. I was hoping it would, but it wasn't like that at all. It was very joyful, as is the friendship.
So in the book, you both signed, it's a series of essays, basically, and they're both, you're identified as the author of sort of consecutive essays, but Were you working in isolation? There was very little cross-germination.
But I believe that Chaz wrote the piece about the cyclists and I put my name on it. I think that's what happened.
At least half of it, yeah. that's her best one, actually.
Play on their emotions and they'll do more than their fair share of the work. No, it was a lovely experience. I've tried writing a book in tandem with people before and you're arguing about every word and it just doesn't get done properly. And the book I wrote before this, I wrote with my husband, Daniel, and we did that also separately. And I think it's a lovely way to work. You've got the best of collaboration in that when you go out and publicise it, you've got your friend with you. But there's no looking at your shoulder going, change that colon to a semicolon, or I'll never speak to you again. Which did happen when I wrote a book with my first husband.
But did you not get together on the sort of, on the germination of the ideas for each?
Yeah, but that was kind of like, you know, lounging around on sofas with glasses
of wine. On hangover days.
Yeah, and that was, so that didn't really feel like work. And there was one bit right at the back, towards the end of the appendix's bits that we sort of, you know, literally like aren't identified as either of us because we wrote together. And there's one called The Hypocrite's Ultimate Weekend, which is just a sort of a jokey, fictional short story about this couple having the ultimately hypocritical weekend. And that was
the
one
bit... We argued over the names.
Yes, yeah.
And what do you want to call them?
Oh, probably someone I work with and wanted
to... Jack and Jill. And I said, they can't, that's too working class. And so they're called Ben and Siobhan.
Something,
I just realised the Hypocrite's Top 10 isn't in there. The records have been taken.
No, I know,
out.
But that was one of the main things.
Why was that libelous? To say it must have been a crap record.
Yeah, I know.
Well, let's have a bit of a closer look at some of the instances of hypocrisy. And the one I want to start with is the green movement and environmentalists, and particularly rich aristocratic environmentalists. You were on the radio yesterday with the lovely George Monbiot.
Well, you know that man. Now that man is a hypocrite because he talks about carbon emissions, right? And he wouldn't let me get a word in edgeways. I said three words, two of which were and the. And I understand today I'm attacked for being a narcissist with no moral compass. Well, everyone knows that. You should come up with something new. Because what I did say, I wanted to say to him, oi, George Monbiot, there was a lot of nasty stuff about you, but that got cut. And then I wanted to say at the end, by the way, I do love your dad's Jaffa cakes. But then Charles said, don't be silly and just use insulting terms. That he said, try and be serious about things. And so he was on the radio going, people say I'm a posh, pretentious idiot, but I'm obviously not one. And the great thing he came out with was, when the Radio 4 man, the man on Today, said to him, but it is true that the working class don't care about things like this because they have more immediate pressing concerns, Judge Monbiot came out with this survey I've never heard of, in which he said, my good man, that's just not true. It's been proved that social classes C, D and E care more passionately than classes A and B. I don't freaking believe it, man. The freaking pack of lies. Sorry.
Anecdotal evidence doesn't back it up, really, does it?
But you really see homeless people on the embankment going, oh no, oh I can't use that hairspray, I can't sniff this solvent, it might ruin the bloody carbon. What's
it's
it?
It's the talk of Blue Water. Every time you go to Blue Water, you know, it's not hoods now, it's oh my goodness, what more can we do?
And it's accent. A blatant falsehood. I won't say lie.
So let's look a bit more closely at some of the why do you think the other members of the environmentalist movement could be accused of hypocrisy?
Because, as Jeremy Paxman said, the environmental department of the BBC, their job is to chase around the world on aeroplanes, telling people how bad it is to go on aeroplanes. And Michael O'Leary of Ryanair said last week, I love these Greens, they're our best customers. Always fine after their demonstrations. It's based, I think air travel is the thing you can probably get them quickest to book on. Every era of their life, though, you know, don't have too many children. When you see a green family, I mean, it's like fashionable now to have at least four, and they're saying that the planet's overpopulated. They mean that working class people shouldn't spawn. They are still conservatives at heart. They mean that single mothers shouldn't spawn, but they can spawn as much as they wish. And I do find that filthy. I think there is a very visceral and strange, unwholesome interest that some green people take in the sex lives and reproductive abilities of poorer people, which in the old days we'd have just called straightforward paternalism and snobbishness. But now that the upper classes cannot respectably tell the working classes what to do on economic grounds, greenery is one way to bully the working classes. And if the working classes respond and say, but hang on, I don't have much anyway, you can then say, oh, you're raping the planet, shut up.
There does seem to be, there's quite a sort of nasty strain of
inappropriate paternalism.
Well, I was thinking that there's almost people are looking at sort of population control and things, aren't they? And in that sort of scary way, that if it wasn't for the sort of excuse of environmentalism, they would think it was like, you know, the most evil thing imaginable.
And another thing about, oh, the third world mustn't have this, that, or the other. The third world would do what it bloody well likes to do, and the white man is not going to tell the Indians and the Chinese what to do. And the Greens do seem to be literally gobsmacked that they can't tell yellow and brown people what to do anymore. And surely, old chap, isn't it where the world's gone mad?
And it's interesting that this essay, more than so far in the publicity, more than any, has created so much interest, because it is a brilliant essay. It's probably the best one in the book, but it's also because
Chaz wrote the ending.
Of all, and so well. But I thought the anti-war movement, which obviously we'll come to probably in time in this chat, but I thought it'd be them that would all erupt. But it just goes to show another level of, maybe it's not hypocrisy with the Green, but just annoyance, is that they just don't believe they should be criticised. They really do. It's like they really believe they're above any criticism.
Like the royal family.
Yeah, and I really think that. It's very male as well, you know, movement. But then I suppose that it's not alone in that.
There was a film on Channel 4, wasn't there, which just with some scientists did question about global warming.
Well, you're talking about the not hopefully not the great global warming swindle one, a Martin Durkin documentary, which was
then criticise it on the grounds of being shabby filmmaking. Don't just throw your hands in the air and say it must be stopped.
Yeah, which is exactly what was going on. Well, Chaz, you mentioned the anti-war movement, so let's get straight into that. How do they feature in the book?
I mean, that's where we took the name from, not in my name, because that was a slogan, of course. I mean, there's a long essay in there by me about that. I mean, I think the main hypocrisy is it's just the relative concern about democracy. Their big argument with Blair was that he wasn't listening to them when they were protesting. Why won't he listen to us? Why is he going to go off and do what he wants to do? Why won't he listen to our marches? It's undemocratic. In order, but the end result of what they wanted was democracy to not be brought to the Iraqi people, and however much they say, no, that's not what we wanted. It's like, that's exactly what they wanted. So that was quite an obvious hypocrisy. And also the fact that a lot of them are also part of the civil liberties sort of bandwagon. And I said in the book, I said, there's only two things that gets them off their backsides. It's any question of a decrease in their own civil liberties, or any question of an increase in Iraqi civil liberties. You know, it's the two sort of things. And then there's just level after level. I mean, they all had a go at everyone. I think everyone did at Tony Blair and said, oh, he just listens to focus groups. He's a weak leader. He's just based on popularity. And then he knew full well when he went into that what the outcome for his popularity was going to be. And then they sort of said, God, he's mad. He goes up and does this. And he is. You know, I really respected him for doing that. And the more so because it made him so unpopular. You know, Bush, who I have no truck with at all, but Bush wasn't doing such a popularity risk. Blair knew what the score was. It wasn't the Falklands where Maggie did that knowing, I'm saying it was the wrong thing to do, but she did it knowing it would secure her the next election. Blair knew the opposite. That's probably one of the most hypocritical movements ever, I'd say.
So let's talk particularly about this Not In My Name thing, which I mean, obviously, as you said, you've chosen that for the title of the book, and that's where it comes from. But what did you think was particularly pernicious about that?
It's the selfishness of it, and it's most protest movements stress the communal. We shall overcome. We shall not be moved. Not In My Name. It's to put one's own ego and one's importance to the fore in a way which is quite literally mind-boggling. As if anybody knows, if it was everyday Not In Their Name, you know, when we take out people, the Taliban, the bullet doesn't have, you know.
Yeah. Don't get that person who marched.
Fiona Hampstead on it. You know, it's not being done in their name. It's called democracy. And it's done in the name of bringing democracy to people whose names we shall never know and that we can't pronounce. The people whose names we never know and we won't pronounce are the people whose names are important to me, not Dominique and whoever in, you know, NW Twee. It sounded to me like something almost from the self-empowering shampoo advert. Your hair, just for you.
Not in my mane.
Not in my mane. And just the selfishness of it. I saw Harry Jacobson the other day when I was on the Israel march, and I ran across to him, and I waved my Israeli flag, and I said, Mr. Jacobson, is it okay? Can I carry it? And he said, you're a good girl, Judy, a good girl. And then Chaz says, we've written this great book called Not In My Name. And Harry Jacobson said, all those people. What do you say?
He said, and I'd like to kill them with my bare effing hands.
And he's such a lovely, lovely man.
To see him
and
say that, I was
he saw
stunned.
Exactly what we were trying to say.
Yeah,
that
we love him.
These people don't care at all about nameless people. It's white people with proper European names. That's the only thing they care about. Their personal honour, of which they have none, or they'd be pro-war.
So I would assume then that you both presume that we are not all Hezbollah now as well.
What do you think they do with us in this room? I mean, you'd live, we'd be dead.
Yeah. Well, I've got the book.
And then you'd say something, you'd be dead too.
I said in the book, I said, you know, feminist, trade unionist, gay men saying we're Hezbollah now. And then I put one sentence. I put, yeah, good luck with that. Like, you know, we really wish you well.
When we say that even though we dislike Islamism, the Islamists are the least hypocritical people you could come across. They do say, yep, we want to keep women imprisoned. Yep, we want to execute gay people. Yep, we want to get rid of Christian religion and all other religions apart from Islam. They are the least hypocritical people in the world. I believe the reaction of the head of Hezbollah when he saw one of those marches, where Hezbollah, he said, you are filthy people and we want nothing from you apart from your money. Don't presume that you are one of us. Which, you know, I never heard one of them write a letter going about that, saying, we, the undersigned, would like to protest that we are Hezbollah now, Mr. Hezbollah man. But he said, just your money, not your filthy selves. They will not take no. They're like a person who doesn't believe a woman says. When a woman says no, she really means yes. That's what white liberals are like with Hezbollah. Oh, it says no, but it means it really does want us. We're going to keep thrusting ourselves on it.
I wondered whether it was actually a counterplot kind of by Tony Blair. He played, and he said, you know, let's completely... Because that was the only sense I could make of it. Somebody on the other side had said, let's go and completely discredit the anti-war movement. And then, you know, I could imagine him sitting, watching it on TV, laughing.
With that demonic smirk and the eyes going red.
Shree coming from the kitchen, look at this.
You
they only went and done
it. To
I mean, I know he didn't do it, but I just mean it was so nonsensical that that was the only sense I could make out of it.
Yeah. And it does make you think that even though I'm accused of being ignorant and not doing research, and that's all well and good... But it does make you wonder, don't these people even read Hezbollah's, you know, statement of intent, which I have read? Do they not know what Hezbollah stands for? That it stands for imprisoning women, killing gays, and abolishing all other forms of thought apart from Islamism? Don't they? I mean, I know that,
and
I don't know that
so
much.
And to do so with a sword and with a, you know,
and
with a bomb.
And cut people's
heads
off. I don't know much, but I do know that much. Yeah.
What more do you... That's what
that's
I said. What more
do
you need to know? I'm not going to go, yeah, but other than that...
Yeah, but no,
they've got
but.
Great views on, like, income tax.
You know.
Oh, they're brilliant on education. And the roads.
The roads.
They
beautiful.
Make the roads
they
work.
They may cut your head off, but there's good roads to drive along to do it.
Well, of course, there's a rich history of people who made good roads and made the trains turn on well in time.
Yeah.
Okay, so, of course, the other thing that everybody knows but seemingly ignores about the likes of Hezbollah and Hamas is their... You know, is there faithfulness to the tenets of the lost protocols of the Elders of Zion?
Of course.
And obviously, both of you are philo Semites, I think is the word. So let's talk for a bit about how much Israel featured in the book.
Well, I it's the longest essay in it, and I was lucky enough to do it. Julie asked me to do it, which I was well chuffed about. That was the best part about it. I didn't think I'd get near that
one.
I'll
tell you what it was. I'd heard that when I'd been writing about Israel in the newspapers, a few people in Fleet Street, who shall not be named, just said, oh, it's spiritual banging on about the Jews again, which is a charming, charming way to put it, quite expected. So rather than inflict my banging on about the Jews to people, I thought Chaz, who'd rarely written about this subject, apart from the Six-Day War in attitude, should do it. And he's done the most amazing piece in the book.
Well, I was pleased with it because I really had to hold back, you know, rein myself in, because that was the one bit, to be honest, where I wanted... Personally, where I wanted to hopefully change someone's mind in the book. The rest of it, we're just provoking, trying to make people laugh.
Knock about fun.
But in that one, I resisted the temptation to do that. And why? I mean, well, the hypocrisy. I mean, it's just how much, you know, how much you leave out. But I mean, the main one is as I said in the book, I don't believe the pro-Palestinian movement in England gives a toss about the Palestinians whatsoever. They merely use them to knock Israel, which they hate, you know, for the worst reasons. And you see this in every time an Arab person or an Arab state abuses or shafts the Palestinians, there's no marches, there's no anguished editorials in The Guardian. You know, Lebanon have attacked Palestinian refugee camps very recently, indiscriminately, you know, taking them to pieces and a lot of the people in them. And you literally don't hear about it. I do because I follow the Israeli media, but you don't really hear about it here. you know, the Arab states have been absolutely horrific to the Palestinians, arguably far more than Israel ever have been, but also without the reason Israel have, when Israel have taken the gloves off, they've done it because they're trying to not be, you know, wiped out, whereas the Arab people are just doing it mostly just out of, you know, just out of general everyday evil. They're not being threatened by the Palestinians. So that's the main hypocrisy. But then when you get into it, you know, why do so many, when you actually go there, because I went there to do an article for Attitude about gay life in Israel, and you know, it's as close to a rainbow coalition probably as any country in the world, arguably, you know, and yet it's the one that the people who are into their rainbow coalition ideas hate. Now they really do hate it, and yet when you look at all the different tribes, the different colours, the Israeli Arabs who live there, the Tel Aviv, which makes Old Compton Street look like some sort of homophobic ghetto. Yeah, you know, it's so much there. But I mean, you know, it's a long essay, and it's hypocrisy after hypocrisy.
Where's the price of entry alone?
I had to rein it in because I realised I'd gone over 10% of the book when I did my word count, and so I literally had to stop. And we've dedicated the book to Ariel Sharon and Benjamin Netanyahu, partly because we love them and partly to annoy people.
It's so strange because the very first book I wrote, which was an awful book called The Boy That Took Johnny, he wrote with my first husband, we dedicated it to Menachem Begin, and the publishers of it, who were very nice liberal Jewish people, had beneath this, this is uncharacteristic, but the publishers would like to distance themselves from the dedication. So it's funny that my very first book was dedicated to an Israeli, and my latest one to two great Israelis.
So let's talk about where do you think that particular hypocrisy comes from? I mean, why?
You can only think it comes from the oldest, filthiest disease in the world, which is anti-Semitism, because there are no grounds. Relatively, Israel is an incredibly liberal country compared to the other countries in the Middle East. If it is attacked, we didn't want to come to this decision. It's anti-Semitism, and anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, despite what people say.
But do you think? I mean, it's. There's an old sort of strain of anti-Semitism in the British establishment, like,
which has now got a great shot in the arm from Islamism, which has been like the revivifying force, which has brought the old anti-Semitism, which was dying off, the sort of genteel Agatha Christie type, was dying off all well and nicely, and Islamism has given it a great shot in the arm and united these two filthy forces of right-wing anti-Semitism and Islamic anti-Israeli.
So again, what do you think the appeal of to you know, to your normal Hampstead liberal, what is the appeal of something like Islamism then?
Because it gives them a chance. All their lives they've denied that there's anything in themselves which is of to do with bullying or wanting to feel power or inflict pain on people. They've lived in complete denial that they have any sadistic impulses, however mild, and suddenly you are given a blank check to bully and push around a nation the size of Wales, and it goes to their head. And I do believe that people who are anti-Israel get a parasexual and visceral thrill from tormenting Jews. It's the oldest sport on earth, and they are in the noble tradition of tormenting Jews.
And I do think another of the appeal of Islamism and the appeal of Not In My Name, and perhaps I'm probably am being too charitable to them now, but I think there's a real kind of fear as well. And I think Not In My Name, it's kind of what Julie was saying earlier, it's like they were almost saying, nasty Arab men, when you come and bomb us because of this Iraq war.
Cowardice.
Not, I said it wasn't me, I said it wasn't me. You know, leave me out of it.
So low.
And that's as charitable a thing as I can put. And even then, I
think
it's
really
horrible.
Like pond scum.
Yeah, even then, it's horrible. I remember, it's a really weird example. I remember the night we started bombing Afghanistan off 9/11. I went to see Oasis, and they walked on, and Liam Gallagher walked on with a camouflage jacket on and said, "It's fucking war, man." And I just remember thinking, it's not the most articulate thing, but it's better than all the... There were loads of people saying, I think we should flee to Cornwall. You know, they're going to come and get us back. I do like... One of the things I think when we do get on with it is that one thing we do have is we do have a stomach for a battle. And yes, we're not at the front line of it. We're not claiming to be. But we've got the... When people said, you know, but what if you were on a tube that got bombed in response to Iraq? And I said, well, I'd be really disappointed. But it's like, you know...
A coward dies a thousand deaths, and if you think that your life is literally the most important thing in the world, I think back to the great left-wing heroes like Le Passionara, who said it's better to die on your feet than live on your knees. Not In My Name, they want to live on their knees, and they'll crawl across broken glass if they can just hang on to their sliver of life, and if they have to suck Hezbollah's dick to do it, they'll happily do so. And they want get a real kick from it.
And they wanted us all dead before we did anything to Iraq. And they want us all dead for the rest of the time.
As nice Mr. Hezbollah man, who's very honest, said, we hate you for what you are, not for what you do.
Yeah.
So, what do you expect the reaction to the book to
be? What do you think, Chaz? Well, we're going to be like the belle of the ball, I imagine, on the left.
It's difficult because, you know, the sort of people who review books and chatter about books and chatter about issues are the sort of people are basically modern hypocrites more often than not. So I don't think we're expecting a glittering response. You know, if they're really clever, they'll just ignore us. If they're really clever, that's what they'll do. But
just swat us away like an irritating fly.
Yeah.
But I feel they may be tempted to pause in, you know, all at the trough. And that would be good for us, because their arguments don't stand up and ours do, frankly. And that sounds big-headed, and I put my hand up.
And, you know, I think it's the fact that we're doing it in a fun way, because nowadays the fun way of arguing issues is meant to be on the Michael Moore side. It's like Michael Moore, you know, I don't agree with lots of his views, but he does put, and his documentaries are easy.
Knocked on the door and running away.
Yeah, but some of them are really entertaining. He knows how to do it. And mostly people on the side of the fence of those issues that I guess our book comes on have always been quite sober. I mean,
yeah,
Melanie Phillips has great stance on things like that. So does Michael Gove. They've both done good books, but there's not a single laugh in them. And neither did they aim to. I don't think Melanie Phillips was aiming Londonistan to be next to.
That's
is it just
job.
Me as everything
you know,
shit? But it's like.
We're a bunch of knockabouts,
yeah.
Aren't we, you and I?
And so I think that's the thing. I think what really annoys them is that.
It was bloody funny.
We do these things, we say these things, and they know that a lot of it's true. But they also think. But they're actually not.
And they're
attempting,
enjoying themselves
they're not
also.
Attempting to come to our table and sort of sit there and rub their chins, because we're not. We don't want to
we
do
know
that.
What
and
we
it's
believe,
a very funny book.
And that's all there is to it. End of story.
That's great. Julie and Chaz, thank you very much for speaking to me. We'll be right back.